Welcome to Fresh Humanitarian Perspectives, which is a podcast produced by the Humanitarian Leadership Academy. I'm Archie Law, Principal Leadership Advisor at the Academy, and today we're going to be discussing leadership in the humanitarian crisis in Gaza, the challenges and opportunities in working with complex ecosystems in Gaza, and what might lie ahead for the humanitarian sector in the Gaza response. Today, I'm delighted to welcome Jamie McGoldrick to the podcast. Jamie is the UN's humanitarian coordinator in the occupied Palestinian territories. Jamie previously served as a UN humanitarian coordinator in the occupied Palestinian territories between 2018 and 2020. From 2015 to 2018, Jamie was the UN's resident coordinator and humanitarian coordinator in Yemen. He has also worked with OCHA, the International Red Cross Movement, and NGOs. Many of our listeners will be familiar with Jamie as the host of the popular podcast Humanitarian Fault Lines from Fordham University's Institute of International Humanitarian Affairs, which I highly recommend to all of our listeners. I'm a regular listener of Jamie's podcast, and when I heard the terrific news about his appointment in the occupied Palestinian territories, it got me thinking, wouldn't it be interesting to turn the tables, if you like, and for me to interview the interviewer? Jamie, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, Archie. Good to hear from you.
And great to speak with you as well, Jamie. Let's begin by asking, what do you consider to be the most crucial qualities or skills for a leader working in humanitarian aid these days, especially in a complex context like the crisis in Gaza?
Yeah, I would say a couple of things. I would say this: you don't change because you become a leader. I mean, you are what you are, and you just have to look at the strengths and weaknesses you have, and you play to both of them, or you use them both. For me, it's all about being honest as you possibly can, and it's having a serious amount of humility in order for you to sort of get a better understanding of how you learn from people and learn from situations. And I think that humility then allows you to have better conversations with people, and I think it helps with not just the operational but also the more strategic side of things. And I think with that, all of those things, that you have to then demonstrate that you have a courage of your convictions about what you're trying to do and why you're trying to do it. And I think in a case of Gaza, for me and for Palestine, for me, is a no-win situation. So no, it's a situation I don't have to think about twice. I mean, I think it's, don't have the sort of the ego that people have, and don't be the overconfident and the arrogance that people sometimes demonstrate in leadership positions where you are. And sometimes that, I think the humility comes out of a confidence in your own understanding of your own strengths and weaknesses. So I say that's where you'd be.
Yeah, fantastic. Thanks, Jamie. When you talk about humility and then courage in your own convictions, like, can there be a bit of a playoff in those two things sometimes?
Yeah, I mean, the thing they can. I mean, I think you can't just dither on certain things. I mean, you've got to sometimes start to push a little bit so you don't overdo trying to balance consensus with decision making. Sometimes you have to just sort of push into it, and that may come across as not being humble. That might be seen as arrogant, but sometimes you have to look at the risk aversion issues. You have to look at the judgment. And I think that don't overdo the need for consensus and participation. And you can have problems in that regard. Some people think you're pushing too hard, too fast. Some people think you're taking a decision without being consulted. And sometimes in these fast-moving, fluid environments, you have to do as much as you have to do in terms of collaboration, cooperation, and outreach. But at the same time, you don't get bogged down in it, and therefore you don't actually end up making the decisions that are necessary. And that's where I think that the courage comes in. But at the same time, I think you've got to be aware that you don't make it look like, and perception wise, that you're being quite dogmatic, and that it's getting that balance right.
And Jamie, I mean, you've obviously been doing this for some time now. Have you noticed much change over the years, particularly around the issue of, say, risk aversion amongst leaders, and I suppose the constraints that have been, you know, placed on leaders over the last decade or two, particularly by organisations, I'd probably argue, as well as some donors?
Yeah, I mean, I think the landscape's changed tremendously over the last 10, 15 years. I think there's the whole counterterrorism issue that goes into donors thinking and how they fund. I think that runs counterintuitive to the whole localization issue, where you do have to take risks. And I think that people pull back from risk taking right now because there is a lot of scrutiny on what you do as a humanitarian coordinator or as a leader in these positions. And you sometimes are walking on eggshells that you get it if you're in a context like here. If you get it wrong in terms of what you've done or what you've said, it can put you in a difficult position. And I think there's also, you know, I think there's a sort of a timidness that appears in the Security Council now because of the sort of the way it's frozen geopolitically. And we see that not just in this crisis, but in other crises as well. And I think people are then therefore probably less willing to take a gamble because if you make that mistake and you get labelled as, and then you get pushed out of a country or you whatever might happen, it's very difficult for the system to back you up because they themselves are locked into the geopolitical polarised world we live in. And so I think all of that, then the pressures that are put on you as an individual, I think it makes you more reticent and therefore more unwilling to take a gamble, make a judgment call, make a statement, make a decision, whatever. And I think that can blow back on you. And you don't see many people coming out to support you when the decision's made that you've maybe crossed the line and you get the negative blowback from a government or from a donor. You don't necessarily see that the people coming to your rescue. So I think all of that builds a sort of a unwillingness to be risk, sort of taking risks where you don't have to.
And how do you approach that, Jamie? Because you're obviously working in a context where you're taking those sorts of decisions every day.
Yeah,
how do you get that courage to back yourself, I suppose?
Well, I think for me is that you know what you're trying to do is the right thing. I think that if you've analysed what you need to do and this is the best course of action you think you should take, and you judge it on the basis of you understand the background in which you work and you understand the fault lines in terms of where the political issues are, you understand where you're going to get support and where you're going to get punished. And I think that was based on a stakeholder analysis of where you go in and what kind of decision, who would it affect, and how do you make a decision that protects the action you want to take, but at the same time protects you as the person who presses the button for the action to go ahead. And I think that, for us, our brains are not wired to deal effectively with uncertainty. But at the same time, in these uncertain environments, you have to be able to make judgment calls and make those judgment calls based on a confidence that you've done your homework, a confidence that you understand where the pressure points are. And then you work on that. And it's a lot to do with, you know, having, you know, your emotional antenna to be fine-tuned, you know, not dull, but you understand the risk that you're taking by going this way. And at the same time, you've got the confidence that you've done enough thinking and, you know, you've mulled it over enough and you've done your homework that you know that you're on, for the most part, safe ground. And that's how it works. And I think by being transparent with as much as you can with all the actors and, be, I think, quite straightforward and not try to confuse what you think is strategy with what you think is tactics. And I think those things help a great deal.
And your experience must come into play a bit with that as well, Jamie. I mean, you'd be familiar with most things you encounter, I imagine.
Yeah, I mean, I think getting the exposure, I've been lucky, very, very lucky to get the jobs I've always had. And this one in particular, this is the place where I always wanted to end my career. The last time I was brought back for this temporary position until they find a longer term one. So for me, there's a sort of there's a tie to what I don't like to see injustice. I don't like to see that happening anywhere. And then as long as you can park that and you can deal with the situation quite soberly in terms of what's emerging, and then you as an individual have got to lead the country team and take them somewhere because you are the system's leader here. And, you know, you don't have any formal authority over the different parts of the system, the stakeholders and the constituencies. But you have to find a way of building that collaboration and alignment. And you've got to base it on trust and sort of shared goals or shared understanding of what our impact should be in this context. So I think I can do that because I've done it before. And it's not an overly confident belief in myself, but I think I know what my limitations are. I know how to use those. And I've a lot based on mistakes I've made in the past, and a lot based on things that have worked in the past. And you use that as your toolbox for when you face adversity or you face a complex situation that you have to get around. And I just think that's what you have to do. Without, you know, I think it's essential for us to be adaptable, you know, because we're looking for results from a different group of people with a different different points, different goals, different values, and you have to try and get them aligned to allow you the space to get through and make that decision.
And Jamie, when we're talking about leadership and values, I'm really interested in, say, what personal values of yours or principles guide your overall leadership approach?
Well, to me, I like the idea of fairness. I really detest bullying. I don't like strong arming. I think that's something that really, it's always annoyed me, even as a young child. I grew up in an Irish family in Scotland. And we were Catholics in a very Protestant neighbourhood. And so you had to sort of understand that, you know, where you stood and why you were there and, you know, the reasons how you lived. And my parents would always have a great notion for them. It was always the idea, it's not what you're given, but it's more about what you do with what you've got, and you make the best of that, and you try to, you know, do as best you can, be as fair as you possibly can, and be as helpful to people as you possibly can. And I think that's the sort of the stuff I've always had as a sort of the core values. And then on top of that, it's just actually trying to, you know, not impose that, but trying to convince others that this is a good way to be, this is a good way to go, and then use that as your sort of way of sort of collaborating, cooperating, coordinating, call it what you want.
And so when you were young, you know, and you're being brought up, Jamie, is that the sort of thing that's, you know, family values, I suppose, as far as, you know, collaborating, cooperating, that sort of thing?
Yeah, I mean, I grew up in a big Irish family in a strange country and in a sort of an environment which wasn't always conducive. And so it was important that you understand what those dynamics were and how you sort of, you developed a pathway through them, you know, in order to not just survive, but to socialize and to be part of something. And then with that came, you know, the idea of ambition, the idea of trying to sort of, I've always been interested in sort of trying to help people, help things get better. And so I think that comes from, you know, my parents were quite in that way themselves, quite religious in sort of sense. So they always had that as values that we were instilled with. And I think I kept them I still work with them to this day.
Yeah. Now, thanks. And it seems when we talk about collaboration, it seems that the decision-making process in the humanitarian sector, particularly over the last 15 years or so, has been shifting from quite a centralised approach to a more collaborative approach. Can you share a specific example of a tough decision you've had to make leading this humanitarian response and how you navigated your way through it?
Yeah, I mean, like in any of these things, there's always, in these type of environments, there's always decisions that have to be made. And, you know, you can't always, you know, get consensus. You can't always get the everybody around the table agreeing with what you need to do. If you understand what it is and you agree and you feel you know how to get that done, then you may have to push back on a few people. I mean, for us here in Gaza in particular, it's a very fraught environment, security-wise, political-wise, and scrutiny-wise, and just the general getting moving around the place is very challenging. And then when you have to deliver food aid or other assistance into places in the north, for example, which are cut off because of the IDF, the Israeli Defense Forces, constraints they put on us in terms of deconfliction, of, you know, our movements, the lack of access, you know, all of the sort of humanitarian principles that we're supposed to have under Geneva Conventions, international humanitarian law. I mean, that's the frustrating background in which we work. And if you want to try and get assistance in there, you may have to push back on that, which not push back too far that they then block you, but push back enough. And, you know, for our own selves, we are quite locked into, you know, a security system that's not always as flexible or as nimble as it should be. And I've had cases recently where we've had to avoid the trucks getting attacked during the daytime. And you've seen some of the incidents, the flower massacre, where hundreds of people were killed during an Israeli pushback on a crowd that came to trucks that we were trying to deliver. So, you know, we need to find ways again. So we designed a way that you would do the trucks leaving very early in the morning or very late at night to arrive early in the morning into the north and to avoid the crowds. And we had big fights with the Department of Safety and Security, who didn't agree to nighttime convoys. And that was something I just stood my ground and just pushed back and said we had to do this. And it did work. And we've now got a longer timeline of how we deliver assistance into the north, which is much needed. So it's not just the daylight hours. We've got an extension of that. And there's a lot of risk involved in it. And I've got to sign off on the risk every night. But it's something that I feel as though that if we don't get the food in there, we don't take away the desperation. We don't take away the desperation. We don't take away the insecurity. So it's a sort of a catch-22 that we have to work with. And it was a tough decision. It was quite a long, hard discussion with Gilles Michaud, who's the Undersecretary General for Department of Safety and Security in New York. But I've got to say, he was, once he saw what we're trying to do, he was fully on board, and his team here got on board as well. So that was a tough one, but we got there.
Did it take much to persuade him? Because it would be really difficult, isn't it, when you're in New York and you've got someone, you know, from the ground calling in, I need to do this. It's not an unfamiliar situation, but that's a tough call for him too, isn't it?
Yeah, very much so. And, you know, I'm very aware of that. And I had prepped him in advance. And he's seen me in action in other places as well. So he knows that I'm not a maverick. I mean, I'm doing it because the need is great. I'm doing it because we have to do it. There's no choice. And it will have a knock-on effect positively for the environment we're then going to continue to work in. So we had the conversation and he accepted the rationale, and it worked. And hopefully, yeah. I mean, it's a very insecure environment. So it might work today, but it might not work tomorrow. So it's something we just have to keep checking and retesting, and then hoping we can get that stuff done in such a way that the security becomes an enabler for the security management of the UN becomes an enabler and not a sort of a blocker. And that's where we need to be.
Yep. And Jamie, you mentioned the challenges of access, which have, you know, obviously been, you know, very well publicized, and the media is carrying a lot of stories on the challenges of humanitarian access in Gaza. And, you know, you're working in one of the most politically charged, complex contexts in the world today. What's your approach to navigating those political complexities that, like you say, they come up every day and they seem to change every day as well, like the overall situation? How do you approach that?
I think you do it at different levels. I mean, you have technical and operational people do their work in terms of understanding why the constraints are there and how to get around them. I think that's one set, and you get a clear knowledge of what the blocking and what the enabling possibilities are. I think then what you do is you try and work out what your operational requirements are. You give that to the people who are in charge of access, so controlling the movements, and that's in this case the Israeli Defense Force. You have a conversation with them. You try and do it directly with them, but sometimes it's difficult. You have to do it through interlocutors like two other parts of the system. One's called COGAT, which is a sort of it's the interface of civilian with military for us. And sometimes those messages get through clearer than and quicker than they should. Sometimes they don't. And then that becomes the problem of then taking it to a higher level. And the idea is to try and have the conversation with people who understand. And then you try and flip it on them by saying that you're military, you wouldn't, you know, you've got certain requirements to make your operations successful as we have. And then we start to have a conversation about what it is we need to be successful and to have an optimal ability to respond. And at the same time, aware of what their constraints are, because they don't trust what we're doing. They don't trust the way we deliver, or who we deliver it to, or who receives it at the end. So it's an ongoing conversation, and it's not one you stop. It's one that just keeps, you just have to keep asking more questions and giving more answers. But at the end of the day, you've got to do it on the basis of you understand the situation. Secondly, they trust you and you trust them that what you're doing and what you're saying is right. And then I think what you have to then do is to be as straightforward as possible, and you're doing it and you lay out very clearly you're doing it for humanitarian purposes, and what they're doing is not humanitarian, what they're doing is military. So there's a lost in translation there. You have to get civil mil people to do some of the conversation, but when it comes to the high level political engagement with the, you know, the head of the IDF or the head of various ministries, be it the defense ministry, you have to have a different type of conversation. And I think those that level, not the politically charged thing, but the actual not the politicians, but the people who run these big departments and ministries, that conversation, and people like the president of the country as well, you have conversations with him about reinforcing what it is you're trying to do and how you're trying to do it. And then more importantly, say to them, you have a responsibility, without going down the road of the Geneva Conventions, international humanitarian law, because that doesn't work. You have to humanize that, or you have to normalize that by having conversations, using language which is not threatening legally, but it's actually letting them know they have a responsibility and what that should be in order for us to do our work. And so it's all of those different levels come together.
Yeah, and I mean, in the context you're in, where they have the IDF and the Israeli government generally has a really sophisticated understanding of international humanitarian law, I can imagine those sorts of conversations get pretty tricky.
Yeah, they do, but I never refer to international humanitarian law or any of that stuff when I speak to them. I talk about principles. I talk about operating principles and operating requirements. And for us, it's to be seen to be independent and impartial as much as we can, and for them to understand what that looks like and how we operate. Mm. And then I think at the same time, we actually give them basic operational requirements, and we talk technically to people about, we need the checkpoints to be open different hours. We need to have the ability to notify you about our movements and not get approval for our movements. And you start to work on those things, as well as the mechanical stuff, like letting them know that we need radios and communications equipment, and we need armored vehicles, which they don't like us to have because they think it will fall in the hands of Hamas and others. So that's a constant battle for us, to have those operational requirements, both the mechanical side, but also the operational side as well.
And imagine your previous experience, in OPT and your networks, they must be invaluable in that way as well. Just your general understanding of the situation too, I imagine.
Yeah, I mean, I think because I'm a known quantity with some of the same actors that were here when I was here, I mean, that's good and bad, because they know you and they know how you operate, and that can be, they can use that against you sometimes. But here I think it's been helpful to have those connections, and so you don't have to prove yourself, because when I worked here the last time was when COVID was taking place, and we worked very closely with all the parties on all sides, and you built up a connection with those people who are still around. And then that helps you, then you don't have to, introduce yourself and show that you can do this and that, because you've got some sort of track record with them in the past. And that's been helpful in a big way for me to get things done quicker and get into, the system better on the Israeli side, and even on the de facto side as well, because you've still got the same connections both on the ground and outside. And that helps for us to make sure they understand clearly what it is we need, and make sure clearly understand what it is we're doing. And then equally, they understand you can just remind them on a regular basis of how we do this together. You're doing it for different reasons, but we have to get this end result the same, which is to save lives.
Yeah, and Jamie, you've mentioned a lot of different players so far. Like, you've mentioned governments, like the military, obviously people on the ground. We know that the UN, NGOs, the private sector has a big role to play, obviously, in delivery of humanitarian assistance in Gaza. And it feels like there's more and more actors becoming involved in humanitarian response generally. At the Academy, we do a lot of work now on ECHO leadership, which is where we work with leaders to really understand the ecosystem they're working in and how to work with the various stakeholders in that ecosystem. And it strikes me that this whole ecosystemic approach is something that's really important in Gaza. And so how do you promote that sort of systemic approach to humanitarian action in the response in Gaza, so that you maximize the impact of all those diverse stakeholders, and how you get them to work together?
Yeah, I think it's having an open approach, and it's having them to come in without overcrowding the field. I think it's important that you understand what they're bringing to the table, be it private sector or be it donors. I mean, in the years that I've been working here, more and more donors are more present in the field, and sometimes deep field, and they're certainly now more present in the humanitarian country teams, which was never the case 10 years ago. And so that level of scrutiny and oversight is a lot closer to what it used to be. I think the arrival of new actors that have come in, obviously there's more and different diverse types of NGOs that have arrived, and the UN itself has expanded, and there's 30 odd UN agencies, and they all have a part to play in, you know, the different parts, that be it from political, development, humanitarian, and then the private sector as well. And I think it's quite easy to get sort of overwhelmed by all of this, all these pressures. But I think you've got to be quite focused on what it is you're trying to do. I mean, this whole idea of Nexus that came out a few years ago, I always thought that was a bit of an overly engineered approach to things. It was to try and force people into a space that probably is there, but it's not a space that's stable. And I think to try and get people in that, it's more about what are all the diverse actors, what's the commonality that you have to seek, find and use. And that's something I don't think we've actually quite mastered yet. And I think there's a lot of work goes into that. And it's like, have you got the triangle of development, peace, and humanitarian? It's never the same. It keeps moving around. Some point in time, the politics is more up there. And then the human rights side, which is not part of it, needs to be part of it. So I getting diverse actors in the room is never really a problem. I think you have to be clear what the purpose of you having the meeting with them is and what the outcome is you're trying to get. And if you've got too many from too many different diverse backgrounds and approaches, you're never going to get there. You're just going to spread rather than narrow the focus. And I think it's important that you do it with an understanding of what they all bring to the table and when do you bring them in. And I think that's how you have to operate it.
And when you've got all those diverse actors that you're dealing with, there's obviously a lot of like differences in power, and particularly when you're talking about, say, if it's governments or UN agencies, donors, and then you're bringing, community representatives, local NGOs to the table. Yeah. How do you try to level that out as a leader, Jamie?
Well, I think, it's a bit like this idea of forensics, that cold forensics, a cold look at something. So what you would do is that you would read the room. Before you go into the room, you envisage what's going to be there. You understand the background checks you've done of what are the issues that are ones that are going to be causing issues in the room, what ones that would pull people together. And that's based on some sort of stakeholder analysis you do of that there. And then what you need to do then is, by reading the room, you need to sort of use your emotional antenna, as it were, to make sure that you see and you perceive and you observe and you sort of deduce sort of in a shrewd sort of way, reading the people and the situation. And from that, you can come out with something which is something which people are gravitating towards, and you have to push them or lead them or whatever to get to that place where you want to be. And I think it's essential in that sense that you're adaptable, that you can move with that, and you're not locked into a position, because what you're hearing in the room and what you're listening to in the room affects where you want to take the room. Because if you're the person who's sitting there as the system leader, you don't have any formal authority over individuals. You don't have the stakeholders and the different constituencies. They're there for their own purposes, and it's to try and find where there's all of that overlap for you to get there. And you build that, a collaboration and an alignment on trust and the idea that we all want to get, there's a certain shared goal we want to reach, and you have to try and define that collectively. And then hopefully that gets you to that place where people are not resisting, but they're actually pushing into where you want to head as a group, as a system.
And Jamie, you've mentioned the emotional antenna a couple of times in the conversation, and its importance. I mean, really curious to understand, how have you built yours, and how do you work with your people to strengthen their emotional antennas?
Yeah, I think it's a lot to do with it. The first question about your honesty and your humility. You should be there, with a better learning understanding of what people are coming from and what their opinion is and why they have that opinion, and know what's behind where they're coming from. And some of it's personal, some of it's mandate organization, some of it's opinion, some of it's blind belief. It's all of those things. And I think you just have to be aware of all that. Some people are quite dogmatic. And it's about, it's like in your own life, chairing a meeting or running a humanitarian country, it's the same thing. There are different people there, and you work with them differently, you approach them differently, you interact with them differently. And it's try and do that in a room full of difference. And it's to try and get people, in such a way that you're tuned enough to know where that person's coming, because you've done your homework and you know they've got a past on a certain issue, and you try and bring that into the conversation, and you know what their mandate is and what their approach, you know what they're going to talk about, or either it be children or health or what. So what aspect of that can you get them to focus better on where we are? And that's all about sort of, and it's done through humility, it's done through being honest, transparent, it's also done through, you know, light touch humor, it's done through sort of self-depreciation and all that stuff. I think there's a lot of tactics you have to use, and it's not one that you can use. I mean, and so having your emotional antenna in a sort of a quite an open way allows you to, I think, absorb that better. And I think I don't think you can teach people anything. I think people just learn from what they see and hear, and what stories you tell them, what stories they hear. I think that's how people learn and reinforce where they are. And, you know, it's that creating a workplace that's got the ability for people to learn and reflect without being scolded, without being criticized. And I think to take that out of the room, in these type of environments, there's always a lot of, I mean, I wouldn't say hostility, but there's sometimes there's sort of an anger that frustrated people don't get to get what they want. And they think they know what it is that should happen. But that's only their viewpoint. And it's trying to put that in the mix to make it part of a collective. Because if it's not collective and not collaborative, it's not going to work.
Thanks, Jamie. Okay, so Jamie, the humanitarian sector is increasingly emphasising the importance of locally led humanitarian action and supporting first responders. Can you talk us through how you actually identify those key local actors and first responders in Gaza, given all the political and security concerns that you're working with?
Yeah, I mean, it's always been a problem for localization in the context of Gaza. I mean, we've been there for decades. The UN and the NGOs have worked there, and they've got good partnerships. But it's fraught with a lot of problems because there's a lot of scrutiny on the work we do here from Israeli side, but also from the donor side, who have quite stringent counterterrorism legislation built into any funding they give us. And we have to do massive checks on people that we use as partners. And, you know, it's a challenge in that regard. And now what's happened on the ground because of this disruption caused by the war and the hostilities, people have moved, and those NGOs who we worked with in those areas have moved as well. So we're having right now to try and recreate that, to try and get that back on track so that we can use them as the support to support the work on the ground, because we can't do it as internationals. We just don't have the spread, don't have the capacity. And we have to, I think, transfer that to NGO partners we've used in the past. But that said, some of the areas in the north, for example, we don't have many partners because they've shifted south. And if we're going to increase our ability to supply in the north, we're going to have to look for new partners, or to try and get existing ones who are currently displaced, get them to go back. And these are things we're working on right now. I mean, localization for me is something that we shouldn't have to sort of prescribe it from the Interagency Standing Committee. It shouldn't be something we get forced to do and something that we get measured against. It should be something that we see as a natural sort of development in any circumstance. The first responders, the local actors, even the way back in 2004 when the tsunami took place, we, if you remember all the criticism that came after that, how we bypassed local actors and brought in internationals. And I've seen it myself with the Nepal earthquake, when the internationals turned up in big numbers, they basically undermined, undervalue and underuse national actors. And so we have to make sure we do that in a way that's respectful, in a way that actually creates the state. And that means us working really properly with those actors. But sometimes the system doesn't allow itself to be that interested in it, except maybe in places like Somalia or in places like Syria, where we don't want to put ourselves in harm's way. So we're quite willing to offload or to hand over the only to a certain extent, because the cluster leads and the lead agencies and the head NGOs and all that stuff, where the resources are decided upon, they don't want to give up that hegemony. They want to continue that, and they want to then use that to, not, I wouldn't say enrich themselves, but to take the line for that project or that sector. To have real localization means that you would have to, as an international system, start to nationalize your work by giving up more and more of your work to national actors. And that's something that doesn't happen easy in the humanitarian phase, because we think it's emergency all the time. We think, oh, we're the only ones that can mirroring or handing over to national actors. And I think that's something we have to change.
Yeah, it's interesting to hear it too, Jamie, is that when you, particularly when you mentioned, say, IAC policy, it's that there is often that challenge of, okay, we're not working well with local actors, so we need policies or we need projects or we need processes and systems, rather than we probably need more people on the ground who actually understand how to work like that. We need a bit of a power shift amongst the international actors too.
Absolutely. And I think that's it's a shift that has to change. It's not going to change by being policy driven. It has to be a change of culture. And we have to accept the fact that there's less resources now than ever before and more crisis around. And for us to be more cost effective and much more efficient, we have to use actors who are cheaper by definition. And we have to use in such a way that we get more funding to them for more action they can do closer to the communities that they live in. And I think that proximity to those people who are affected, I think it's helped greater by us empowering them and by resourcing them to do that work and then let them stand alone.
Yeah, exactly. Jamie, when you look to the future, what do you see as the most pressing challenges and opportunities for the humanitarian sector in Gaza? And how do you think leadership needs to evolve to address those challenges?
I mean, I think that the issue will be the fact you've got a whole population in an area which is locked into a space that they can't leave, which has been the case for many, many years, of course. But under this current crisis, it's actually put more focus on that. So there's a degree of, I think, desperation, a degree of sort of situation which is dire. And an understanding that that's not going to go away anytime soon. It'll be a long, long time before people leave tents and go back to where they came from to start to rebuild their lives again. So you're going to have a whole population of Gaza who will struggle. And we, as the humanitarians, will have to make sure that we allow them or help them to get to a place where they want to be, because where they are right now, nobody wants to be in that situation. And it's going to be a long journey for us to work with them and for them to get the responsibility to understand what it is that we can do for them and not and reconstruction quicker than we should. There's a humanitarian phase that we're in right now. Despite it being long, it can't be short-circuited or bypassed. We have to get through that, keep people alive, survive, and then come later. But then the coming to call it was going to be built on a governance structure that has to be there, a security structure that will need to be there. And that's where the complications come in, because who will govern Gaza? And when you reconstruct it, you'll have to have an authority that looks oversees that. Then you've got the land issues, you've got land rights issues, you've got space issues, you've got Israel's security agenda, buffer zones, less space available for the same amount of people. So it's going to be a different Gaza in the future. But while we're here right now as humanitarians, it's our duty and responsibility to keep people alive and make sure we get as much much support to them as we possibly can. And that's not the case right now. So that's what I think are the big challenges. And as a leader, it's up to you who leads the whole system to make sure that we're focused on those goals and we keep people coordinated and focused on getting that result, which is life-saving and survival, until that time changes. And that change will not happen anytime. Yeah, the basic sanitation issues and health issues that are not there at the moment. I don't know how we're going to do that.
Yeah, I can imagine. I just lost a bit of it, Jamie, but I think we got most of that too. Jamie, one more question, and this one's off the cuff. What's a question that I should have asked you and haven't asked you?
A question probably along the lines of, what does the future hold for the humanitarian system? I think that's something that worries me. I see the way it's been instrumentalized, and I see the way it's been politicized in more and more places, and how we are losing our you know, what we stand for. It's getting diluted, it's getting politicized, because I think the world we live in and we work in has changed as well. And I think it goes back to all the way back to the Security Council, all the way back to the sort of the higher level areas of geopolitics. And we are part and parcel of that. The humanitarian is not separate from politics. And it's always been like that, but it's also, I think it's becoming a lot more scrutinized, a lot more instrumentalized. And I think those are the, and I think the humanitarian world, we still believe we're quite naive and what we're doing is right, which I think is probably true. But at the same time, I think we've got to be a lot smarter in how we want to be, where we want to be, and how we want to be independent, impartial, and, you know, able to do our work on the basis of need and people affected by a crisis and not by political realities. And unfortunately, here in Gaza right now, the whole Palestine question is the most politically charged environment you could work in. And there are so many local actors, so many regional actors, and so many international actors have their own view of things here. And what you could say, it's not the people they put first. It's the humanity is overwhelmed by the politics.
And as a leader, Jamie, how do you navigate that end of town, if you like the big politics end of town?
I just think you have to be conscious of it. I think that you have to, and it's getting, using them to your best, to use them to your best ends, but at the same time not to be, you know, derailed by them. And I think you keep them at arm's length where you can, but at the same time be realistic to say that is where the power is, because that's where the money is. And donors make the decisions on not on the basis of what you tell them, it's based on what they think from their capitals and how that aligns with their own geopolitical position or their own foreign policy strategy, whatever it might be. So I think all of those things affect it, and we just have to be aware of that and conscious of it and not be naive and try to work through it and try to get those
The
UNRWA cuts were not done as a sort of logical issue, it was done as a political issue. And I just think that those things are more and more what we're seeing here. People get the funding because they play a certain way. People don't get funded because they play a certain way. And I think that's the shape of the future, because everything's becoming instrumentalized by political forces, which I think are, I mean, globally very polarized. It's the world we live in now is a much different world than, say, 20 odd years ago we started out on this. It's become a lot more restrictive, a lot more constrained, a lot more politicized in the work we do. And I think there's no change to that, to be honest.
Yeah, no, thanks, Jamie. It's a sobering note to conclude on as well. And look, Jamie, I just really want to just thank you so much for your time and sharing your unique perspectives with the listeners of Fresh Humanitarian Perspectives. Been really engaging, interesting discussion on humanitarian leadership and humanitarian leadership in the occupied Palestinian territories. And we just wish you well in all the important work that's going on now and is to come in the coming months, Jamie. So thanks very much.
Oh, thank you, Archie. Much appreciated. Thank you.